The following program contains graphic material, including offensive language. Viewer discretion is advised.
She's got the news. She talks with newsmakers. She encourages us to laugh, and she cries with us. Speaking truth to power and questioning authority daily, it's the Nicole Sandler Show.
All right. Welcome to a Wednesday. We start today on a sad note. Because you know, if you've listened to this program for any amount of time, I am a music lover. Music has been a big part of my life. In fact, music is the key to my sanity, I believe. And one of the formative, one of the bands who dominated my formative years is Fleetwood Mac. And today, the news that Christine McVie has died at the age of 79. They said it was a short illness. Her family was with her, and she passed away today at the age of 79. You know, the moment I saw it, I was actually on the phone with my daughter, Allison, and I went, I caught my breath like, oh no. And she said, what's the matter? And I said, Christine McVie died. And she didn't know who Christine McVie was. And I said, Fleetwood Mac. And she said, oh, no. Yeah. I was in high school when the Fleetwood Mac album, the White Album as it's known, came out. And then, of course, Rumors. Again, those were my high school years. That's what I grew up with. And, you know, I had the opportunity to meet all of Fleetwood Mac, except Christine McVie. She, when I did meet them, she was not part of the group. She took a little break. And when I got to meet the band, she was not part of it. When they did the dance, remember they recorded, did the live broadcast, the dance. It was a taping over two nights. I was actually at both tapings. But she wasn't part of the band then. I've seen her a number of times. And of course, if you tuned in early, before the show starts, I usually play a lovely piece of music that was given to me by the artist Lily Hayden. Today, knowing that I can't play any released Fleetwood Mac music or I'll get copyright violated, I actually pulled, I hate to admit this, the karaoke version of Songbird. And I had that playing as the bed leading up to the start of today's show. Because that's the song, even though Christine McVie wrote most of the big hits, I think she wrote Don't Stop. She wrote so many of them. But I will always associate Songbird with her because she was just so sad. So, and look, we are getting up there in age. This is going to be happening more and more. Christine McVie was 79. A lot of our musical heroes are in that age range, and I'm dreading. I don't even want to say it because I don't want to manifest anything. But you know where I'm going. We're all getting older, and so many of our musical heroes are up there in age, and we've got to prepare ourselves for this. You know, I still remember the day Jerry Garcia died. I was on the air in Los Angeles at a music station. And we, being the eclectic rock station in town, we were the only ones who went wall-to-wall Grateful Dead music. And I wound up hosting a big vigil that night at Griffith Park. We became the place where everybody went. Yes, we still have Stevie. She's still touring, even. But yeah, all the rockers were born in the 40s. Yeah, we're getting up there. So we have to know it's the circle of life. And, you know, the one beautiful thing about these musicians is, in a sense, they never go. They leave us with all this amazing music that lives on after they're gone. So we can take a little bit of comfort from that. But it is sad. It's the end of an era. I mean, Fleetwood Mac dominated the airwaves from my time in high school through the beginnings of my radio career when I played a lot of their music on the air. So So it is sad. Yes, yeah, somebody in the chat room just said, Stevie Nicks is from Arizona. She is. And hi, Ashley. Ashley says, I can't lie. I'm excited for Nicole to move here. We are the spunky little liberals that can here in the desert Southwest. I am so looking forward to it. Frankly, I cannot wait. Now, today is November 30th. It happens to be finally the end of hurricane season. Yay! We dodged a couple of huge bullets this year. Where I live in Southeast Florida, we were in the line of fire twice, and we got very lucky. The rest of the state, not so much, but where I am, we did. So I'm thrilled that this will be my last hurricane season. So I'm done with that. Trucker John says, that's why I don't get too sad when old people die. It's inevitable. So yeah, grieve it, but don't let it devastate you. And no, I won't. You know, but I can imagine how I'll feel when, you know, yeah, there's Christine McVie, and I'm sorry she's gone, but it is life, and it goes on, and thankfully the music lives on. And as big as a fan, look, I remember playing her. This is how eclectic my musical taste has been. And when I first started in radio, I did freeform stuff and could play whatever I wanted. And her first album was called The Legendary Christine Perfect. That was her name. Her maiden name was Christine Perfect. And the album, The Legendary Christine Perfect, is really good. If you can find it anywhere, it's probably still online somewhere. But she married John McVie, the bass player for Fleetwood Mac. And though they split up many, many years ago, she kept his name. So, yeah. Hi. Yes, you got something to add, David?
Yes, you mentioned manifesting.
Yes.
You just said, this will be my last hurricane season.
Yes.
Please amend that.
And
say,
Florida.
This will be my last hurricane season
in Florida.
Number one. Number two.
Yes.
I have a Fleetwood Mac story.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
So, as you know, I lived in Arizona for many years, and one of my close friends and former roommates had a small chain of record stores, and he used to do promotions for concerts. And as a result of that, he got to know Stevie Nicks' dad.
Okay.
And at a certain point before Stevie ever joined Fleetwood Mac or ever became anything famous whatsoever, he tried to fix me up with her. And I said, are you ready for this?
What?
Thanks, but no thanks, because I didn't want to be involved with anyone in show business.
Oh, how funny.
And look at where I ended up.
Yep. And I don't think you ever met Stevie, but you know, her manager was, we've lost, you know, touch. We still talk from time to time, but her manager was one of my best friends when I was living in LA, Cheryl. And she still manages Stevie and Chris Isaac. And, so David's gotten to meet Chris Isaac, but I don't think ever Stevie. But yeah, I mean, it's hard not to think in those terms where, I'm not even going to say it. You know what I'm thinking, and so we won't go there. But speaking of music, this Friday, we are going to take a break from politics, and we are going to talk to one of the most legendary music producers of all time. His name is Bob Ezrin, and you may not know his name, but you certainly know his music. I think he's most famous for Pink Floyd's The Wall, for Peter Gabriel's first album that was called Peter Gabriel. There were three of them called Peter Gabriel, but he produced the first one. He produced, I think, every album Alice Cooper ever made. The list goes on and on. The man is, you know, he is a legend. And I got to work with him many years ago. In fact, as we taped the interview on Friday of last week, the day after Thanksgiving. And I'm going to play it back this Friday. It's a great way to lead into the weekend. And the way we started off the interview is by talking about sorry, I'm losing my train of thought. How we made internet radio history together. And we did. And I'll explain it all on Friday. But I'm just letting you know, if you're not into music, yeah, you may want to skip Friday's show. But you should listen because, again, we talk about radio history, internet history, and a lot of his musical stories. And I just watched the whole thing again today to see if I needed to edit anything because we really went for the full hour. So I had to make sure it fit into an hour. And it does, just barely. So I encourage you to listen. I think you'll enjoy it. But it will be a break from politics. And, you know, sometimes we need a break from politics. Now, today, we don't have a break from politics. Let me tell you what's going on today. This morning, you know, I get up very early. Actually, I don't sleep much at night. So I'm up and down and up and down. And when I finally give up on sleeping, I come out, give Jackson breakfast, make some coffee, and get online and start reading and preparing for my What's New segment that I produce every morning. And I go on Twitter, and I see a tweet from Jeff Charlotte. And if you've listened to the show for any amount of time, you know that I'm a big fan of Jeff Charlotte's. He is the guy, he's one of those unusual creatures. He's a college professor. He teaches a very specialized form of writing, and that makes sense because he's a brilliant writer. That's the thing. He's the guy who wrote the book The Family, and then the follow-up book C Street. The two of them combined and were made into that Netflix documentary docu-series called The Family about C Street. And he's written a number of books. I've been fortunate enough to have had Jeff on the program early on. I think maybe not when The Family came out, but when C Street came out. And he's been a semi-regular guest ever since then. And I'm still a little intimidated by him because he's so smart. I know I'm pretty smart too, but he's super smart. And, you know, sometimes I'm just trying to keep up with him. Anyway, Jeff Charlotte has a new piece that he tweeted out this morning in Vanity Fair magazine. And let me bring it up because it is just so good. It's something you must read. It's called The Great Acceleration, quote, fuck Biden, quote, don't tread on me, and a Wisconsin death trip for our times. And Jeff Charlotte does this from time to time. He takes these road trips. And he goes through MAGA territory and he talks to people and he learns a whole lot. The difference between this and some of the other things that he's written is that this ends on a really hopeful note. So anyway, Jeff Charlotte will join us in about 15 minutes or so. I look forward to it as I always do when I get to talk with Jeff. And I will link to the Vanity Fair piece from the blog at NicoleSandler.com where I post the show. Vanity Fair, by the way, has a Cyber Week special going on. You do get, I think, like three free articles a month, so you can read it without having to go through the paywall. But they are now offering a year's subscription to print and online for $8. Vanity Fair is one of the magazines that I would actually pay to subscribe to, and I used to. And then I let it go because it got expensive. But I did resubscribe today for that $8. And you get a tote bag too. So if you want to go on the site and read it, you can regardless of whether you subscribe or not. But they do have this special right now. So you might want to take advantage of it. So before we bring Jeff on at the bottom of the hour, let me share with you a little bit of what happened today because it's been a busy, busy news day. Aside from the death of Christine McVie. The House Ways and Means Committee today received 6 years' worth of Donald Trump's tax returns from the IRS. That's all I know. That's all we know so far, but they have them now. So there's that. I guess the big, there were two big stories today. One has to do with the House Democrats' leadership elections, and it happened. They happened today. They've elected the House of Representatives, the Democratic Caucus in the House, unanimously elected Hakeem Jeffries to be the next House leader of the, he won't be Speaker because the Democrats lost control of the House, but he will be the House, I guess the minority leader. Except, I don't know. But then the second in command, Steny Hoyer and Jim Clyburn, kind of stepped down. Well, Steny Hoyer definitely did. Jim Clyburn he doesn't want to give up the power. And so he's trying to retain the fourth position. The vote on that will be tomorrow. He all of a sudden has a challenger in David Cicilline, a progressive. And I say, yes, yes, yes. So that's very possible. Jim Clyburn, who wanted to remain in leadership as assistant leader, is rubbing some people the wrong way. It's like to turn it over to the next generation already. So this morning, David Cicilline said that he challenged Clyburn for the role, arguing for the importance of LGBTQ representation in leadership. I had no idea David Cicilline was part of the LGBTQ community. And you know what? There's no reason I should know because it's none of my business because I'm not in his bedroom. But I understand the desire to have somebody in that from that community in leadership, and I think it would be great. I want to see a progressive in leadership, and David Cicilline checks both of those boxes. Catherine Clark is also somewhat progressive, and she's the second now in command. She's from Massachusetts, behind Hakeem Jeffries. And Pete Aguilar from California is the third guy. This is the first time there is no white man in the leadership, in the top three leadership in the House Democratic Caucus. So that's historic. You know, everything is history now. So that all happened. So there's still some infighting. And apparently, Ted Lieu is now, I don't recall, did I copy it over? The caucus chair. They had those elections today, and Ted Lieu looks like he won. We're going to talk to Howie tomorrow about all of this, because this is his bread and butter. So we'll talk about what happened with the leadership race and all that stuff with Howie tomorrow. We'll also talk about the other big news of the day. Now, in What's News, about a couple of months ago, I covered the story when not many others were talking about it, but I saw this railroad strike looming and saw that the labor secretary, Marty Walsh, had been negotiating with the unions. Now, here's the thing. There are 12 different unions representing about 115,000 railroad workers nationally. And boy, they've been screwed over, those workers, for a long time. So they needed this new contract. So they negotiated a couple of months ago and came to a deal, except four of the 12 unions rejected it just the other day. So that leaves us in a tough position, because if they don't come to a deal by, I want to say, December 18th, don't quote me on the date, I'm not sure, that they will go out on strike. So Joe Biden, understanding that a strike right now would be devastating to the economy. It would slow down the supply chain yet again. We can't afford that. So going on some very ancient, like from the 30s legislation, Congress can override a union vote. It rubs me the wrong way. And especially Joe Biden, who's the labor guy, allegedly. He said, I am going to encourage Congress to pass legislation to basically override it, to say, no, all the unions, you need to take this deal and not strike. And there were some who were not very happy about that idea. Most notably, our old friend Bernie Sanders, who always stands up for the working guy. and girl, the working person. So what Bernie is saying, here's the thing. They got a good raise in this contract, but the thing that the workers still want that they didn't get is paid sick time off. If you work for the railroad and you get COVID tomorrow, you're shit out of luck. You don't have any paid sick days. And so this deal that they negotiated 2 months ago, I think allotted for 1 day of sick leave. Well, that's not good enough. So Bernie Sanders went on Chris Hayes' show last night and talked about it. I want to play just a really quick clip for you so you get what Bernie's fighting for here.
Three quarters of this year alone, the railroad industry made $21 billion in profits, provided $25 billion in stock buybacks and dividends, and they are paying their CEOs, in some cases, $14 million a year, $10
Hello?
Million a year,
oh,
$20
on,
million a year,
on,
whatever
caller.
It may be. Meanwhile, for workers on the railroads, they have zero guaranteed sick leave.
Zero.
When somebody comes down with COVID tomorrow, they're going to get penalized come into work. Somebody is having a baby, can't go to their wife's side. So what we are fighting for, and I think we stand a reasonable chance to succeed, is to take the president, the agreement that the president and labor secretary negotiated, and add 7 days of paid sick leave,
hold on one second.
Sick leave,
okay.
To that.
And so that's Bernie's saying, sorry, caller, you can't hear because it's on the same pot that you came up on. So Bernie Sanders says, well, I'm hearing that there's strong Republican support for it in the Senate, and he pushed through so to get a two votes. So Nancy Pelosi yesterday said, we will bring up two votes. We will bring up the first bill that will allow us to basically override the union vote and vote on that. And then separately, another amendment, if you will, that gives the railroad workers 7 days of paid sick leave. So that happened in the House today. And both passed. The first one, the main bill to impose the labor agreement, passed by a vote of 290 to 137. House Republicans didn't whip on the legislation, so 79 Republicans voted for it. 129 voted against it. And on the Democratic side, eight Democrats said no. And it was a mixed bag. And again, we'll go into detail with this on this tomorrow with Howie Klein. But it was a mix of some very conservative Democrats and some very progressive Democrats. The difference came, and again, we'll get into that tomorrow. The second vote on the legislation to expand the deal's paid sick leave passed on a much more partisan vote. It was 221 to 207. All the Democrats voted for it, and only three Republicans voted for it. John Katko of New York, Don Bacon of Nebraska, and Brian Fitzpatrick of Pennsylvania. Adam Kinzinger didn't vote. I guess he wasn't there. Liz Cheney voted against it, in case you were wondering. All right, we've got somebody holding on the line. Hi, caller. Sorry about that. When I have somebody call on, you can't hear. Who is this?
Proud Scal from Alabama.
Hey, Proud Scal. What's on your mind?
Well, I'm on the mind with the conservatives wrecking things for the railroad workers first.
How did the conservatives wreck? Wait. How did conservatives wreck things for the railroad workers?
They gave them a deal that was not ideal.
Well, okay. I wouldn't blame the conservatives. If you want to blame someone, blame Joe Biden, the union guy, for saying, you know, four of the 12 unions didn't go along with this. We're going to overrule your votes. That's the problem. Not the conservatives. Thank goodness for Bernie Sanders. So he pushed through. So there's this vote. All the conservatives voted to give the workers 7 days of paid sick leave. The problem is going to be in the Senate. In the Senate, because tomorrow The Senate will vote on this. And they need 10. If every Senate Democrat votes for it, and Joe Manchin is undecided on sick leave right now, but he supports anything to prevent a strike, so he's undecided, so they may need 11 Republican votes in the Senate. Right now they have, believe it or not, Ted Cruz, Josh Hawley, and the third one, I'm drawing a blank right now, but a third Senate Republican, who Marco Rubio, said that they would possibly support this. But I don't think they're going to get 10. So with the help of the Senate Republicans, Joe Biden, and I'm sorry to put this on him, but he's the one who brokered this deal, will probably strip the railroad workers of paid sick leave.
It's ridiculous. I think Joe, from his point of view, maybe was striking a deal with the devil because he thought if this would go on longer, it would erase inflation.
No, Proudskill, it's as simple as if they don't have a deal, like in the next week or two, the railroads go on strike. Mm-hmm. The railroads go on strike, we're all fucked. The supply chain stops, and yes, the economy will suffer. So he's trying to do the right thing here. I think he's just going about it the wrong way.
I think you're right. I think, unfortunately, strange things happen inside the Washington bubble.
Yep, that's true.
And I also called because I am upset at the media for not calling the extreme right side of the Republican Party for what it is, a fascist and anti-Semitic.
Yeah. And you know what? There are Republicans who are saying that. Not many of them, but a few. More than the Democrats are. The Democrats are just, they seem to be afraid to offend anybody. And I think most of them need to sit in on a seminar with Bernie Sanders or something to teach them how to speak truth, how to speak plainly and truthfully, and call people out for what they really are. So anyway,
I also called about an amazing sports moment that happened yesterday with the U.S. Facing Iran mm-hmm. in the World Cup.
Right.
Iran, when they go home, faces jail or worse because they refuse to sing the national anthem in several World Cup games.
Yep.
And this is even the people that were supporting the U.S. for this. I wonder if some of the supporters didn't support Kaepernick when he sat out of the national anthem.
Oh, probably. Probably. This is a different thing. I don't see a difference, but it is different. This is another country. The thing that really got to me was when I read that there were people in Iran cheering when the Americans won, because the people of Iran are not supportive of the regime. They want, as the protests should prove by now, that people are taking to the streets, they want rid of that regime for the most part.
I'm excited about your move, and I love the Southwest, and I wish I could travel there more.
Okay.
I really would.
All right, Proudskill. Well, thank you for the call. Good to hear from you.
Good to hear from you.
Bye.
Goodbye.
All right. So, So Jeff Charlotte's going to be joining us in a moment. Let me just share with you a couple more quick clips. Something else happened today. Merrick Garland, you know, yesterday was the verdict. It happened after we got off the air, I think. The verdict in the Oath Keepers trial, or some of it we heard before I got off the air. But I thought only the one guy was convicted on seditious conspiracy or whatever that charge is. Merrick Garland, and there was a second one also convicted on that charge, and all five of them were convicted on this obstructing an official proceeding. All of these charges come with a sentence of about 20 years, so we'll see what they're sentenced to. But Merrick Garland today spoke a little bit about it, and he said this.
Last evening, a jury of the defendant's peers found each of them guilty of serious felony offenses. As the verdict of this case makes clear, the department will work tirelessly to hold accountable those responsible for crimes related to the attack on our democracy on January 6, 2021.
Good. So, and he said in other places, he did a whole little press conference, talked a lot about this, about the special counsel who said things will not slow down one iota. He said it's moving quickly, swiftly, and, it sounded pretty good. As for back to Bernie for a moment, I keep checking over here to see if Jeff's here. Let me play you one more clip from Bernie Sanders talking to those people who have not yet voted on this, the paid sick leave provision. And here's what he said.
Right. Put up or shut up. If you can't vote for this to give workers today who really have hard jobs, dangerous jobs, if you can't give them, you can't guarantee them paid sick leave, don't tell anybody that you stand with working families.
Really? Don't tell anybody you stand with working families if you're not willing to say these people who work their asses off deserve paid sick leave. What he said in the clip I played before, they get COVID tomorrow. They're out of luck. They don't. You have a job. You get paid if you're sick, don't you? I guess unless you're like an hourly worker, you do. Well, they have a big contract negotiation. How do you not negotiate for paid sick leave? I think it's unconscionable. And I think Joe Biden is wrong. And how can he call himself the labor president by saying, well, we're just going to legislate that the union has to go along with this deal, even though four of the 12 unions voted it down? I don't think that's how it's supposed to work. All right. Enough of that. I told you we had a great guest coming up. And as always, I'm always thrilled to welcome Jeff Charlotte to the show. Jeff Charlotte, of course, we know probably most famously for his work. Sorry, Robert and Naples, not taking calls right now. The book, The Family, and the follow-up, C Street, that were made into a Netflix docuseries about the family. He's written a number of great books that I've had the honor to speak with Jeff about on the air. But as I told you earlier, when I woke up this morning, I saw a tweet from Jeff with a link to his newest article at Vanity Fair, vanityfair.com. The Great Acceleration, Fuck Biden, Don't Tread on Me, and a Wisconsin Death Trip for Our Times. And first thing I got to say is you must read this. Because Jeff Charlotte, you are such an amazing writer. I know I've said it before, but you really are. Thank you for writing this. This was a wonderful piece.
Well, thanks for having me on, Nicole. It's always a pleasure to talk with you.
Well, I always enjoy talking with you, too, and I love reading you. And this is one of your classic articles. Now, is this a piece for a book that's coming soon or part of that?
It is, and I'm gonna shamelessly plug it because Please. It is the book that I made. I sort of wanted to get away from writing about the fascists. But the fascists are not cooperating with my retirement plans. So I have a book coming out called The Undertow, Scenes from a Slow Civil War. It's coming in March from Norton. And this is, I don't want to call it an excerpt because I worked with Vanity Fair to make it. But what I did is I said, all right, Vanity Fair, I want to add this chapter to this book. Will you help me travel around Wisconsin? Which I was in Wisconsin for family reasons, but I was there the day Roe fell. And in fact, I happened to be in communication with some folks who were going through, essentially the IVF process. And And I found out that a doctor came in. One of my friends was actually, you know, in the examination room, and the doctor came in crying and said, I can't go forward, because Wisconsin became, on that terrible day, the only blue state in the nation to have suddenly a complete abortion ban, going back to a 19th century law from the very beginning of Wisconsin. So I decided that I needed to add a chapter about this to my book. So it was sort of like a like, all right, Norton, can I, will you, if I go fast, will you let me do this? Because I really think it's important. And I think the fall of Roe was so huge. I had to find a way to talk about it and think about it.
Right. And you've written about road trips that you've taken before and going through these, going to either Trump rallies and into MAGA land. And here you are going through Wisconsin, which ironically used to be the progressive ground zero in this country. And now it's become one of the more wing nutty states, hasn't it?
Well, I wouldn't say that. No, it's complicated. What's interesting, it's become probably one of the most gerrymandered states.
Ah, okay.
It's still a very purple state. I mean, let's look at the fact, not terribly charismatic. I mean, no one accuses their Democratic governor of being charismatic. And he beat, you know, a Trumpy billionaire, Tony Michels. Just barely, but he beat him.
That's all it takes.
And Ron Johnson just barely beat Mandela Barnes.
Yep.
And if you're saying, boy, they'll elect Ron Johnson. Look, I was in Wisconsin for a lot of the last 6 months. Ron Johnson ran what I would call an effective campaign. And I'm a big Mandela Barnes supporter, and I'm big believer in Wisconsin Democrats are a model for the whole nation. I think the Mandela Barnes campaign wasn't the strongest. So Wisconsin is still up for grabs, but that's what's so tragic. It's so gerrymandered. That its state legislature is close, not quite close to a supermajority, and they can pass these laws. They can basically take rule a majority people of color city like Milwaukee and impose this kind of white supremacist rule that's coming out from the suburbs. So Milwaukee is a really Wisconsin is I think right now an emblematic state, a tragic state. You know, as I was driving around Wisconsin, I was reading an audiobook, another great book that I recommend, Barbara F. Walters, Political Scientist, How Civil Wars Start.
Okay.
And she, with a team of political scientists, an international team, sort of compared and contrasted every civil war around the globe they could get data on. In her final chapter, she says, okay, all these factors we've identified everywhere, they're all present here in the United States. That doesn't mean it's going to happen,
right,
but it definitely means it could. Don't tell yourself it couldn't happen here. It definitely could. And so then she hypothesizes, where might it begin? And where is her hypothetical?
Wisconsin.
Yeah. Wisconsin, strong militia state. And also, I mean, that's what's so important about the story. I want to read it. It's like, I can't handle one more ugly story. Look, I've got some hope in this story.
You
hope
do. That's the thing.
Some heroic young kids.
Love it. I love it. I love that it ends on a positive note, that there's optimism for the future. And that's the message that I took away from it. As dark as things can be, there is hope in our young people.
These are a group of kids. I went to Black River Falls. I was guided through my travels by a book called Wisconsin Death Trip by a man named Michael Lessie, who was my teacher and mentor. It's about the 1890s. We all know that, like, the myth of small town America is just that, a myth. It wasn't real, that there's all the same darknesses and so on. The reason we know that has a lot to do with Michael's 1973 book, Wisconsin Death Trip, which sort of broke this kind of this idea of the American pastoral ideal by showing that there's always been madness and arson and infanticide and everything. Human nature. Turns out the good old days, make America great again, why they were just as human as we are now. And maybe in some unfortunate ways more so. So Black River Falls was a subject of his book in the late 1890s. Wow. So I went to Black River Falls and I just pull into the town and I see this group of three young women standing on the bridge over the Black River holding pro-choice signs. This is just a few days after that. And people are driving by and honking and people are driving by and revving their car. And I stop and I talk to them. And in fact, a preacher had gotten out and started screaming they were going to hell. This one woman, I was about to say a little woman, but I didn't mean that in that sense. I mean in the great little Joe sense.
Short.
He's short. He's small.
Short.
And this guy was big with a big belly. I met him. And he got right in her face and started screaming at her. He's a local anti-abortion leader. She stood her ground and her friends came out. They said they could see this, you know, like, we can't leave our friend alone there. And they made their signs. And suddenly you had all these like very nice kids. They were like, you know, student body presidents and so on. There was a cheerleader and I can swear on this show.
Yes,
right?
You can.
I'm so proud. I got to take the photographs for this story. So I really love that. And I'm really proud that they included this wonderful cheerleader, a cheerleader in small town Wisconsin, good wholesome girl named Peyton, and she's got her sign on the bridge, and her sign says "fuck you."
Yes, it does. And hold on, I'm gonna bring
world,
that.
You're gonna take away my rights. Fuck you, which is 100% correct, accurate, the technically perfect response to the overturn of Roe.
Yes, without a doubt. In fact, I was going to hear. I don't get the whole thing in the frame, but here is the picture.
Oh, fuck off! I'm
there,
sorry.
No, fuck off! Yeah,
I misrepresented you, Peyton.
There she is.
And these kids were great. I ended up spending time with them, and one of their moms was a real supporter, and we all went out to Perkins, which is like, you know, one of those late night diners in a small town, and they had heaps of waffles and things like that, and they talked. I mean, they were ready to rumble. They were looking for, they thought there was going to be a civil war and they were ready to go. They were like, all right, it's going to be a revolution. I don't share that youthful enthusiasm. But I do share the willingness to say, hey, we've got to fight for our lives.
Yeah. Right. But so they're the encouraging part. You saw, and they make up the end of the story, and it leaves us on a hopeful note.
Yeah, I'm misrepresenting the story, which is very dark.
Which I appreciate it. But you're doing this tour, and you notice you're driving around, and you notice, and again, you reference the Wisconsin death trip.
Yeah.
So you notice a coffin in front of a house, and you say, "What is that?" And you say you want to get out and take pictures of it. And your friends who were driving, you said, well, you can go, but we're not staying here. They kind of left you there to take the pictures and drove around and then came back and got what was that, just because of they didn't know who you'd encounter?
I mean, you know, it's a shack with a coffin in front and the sort of very eerie green light, you know. And I don't know, maybe it was just a character. Maybe it's just the, you know, town eccentric. This was in Cecil, Wisconsin.
Yeah, there's the picture. It is a coffin. That's
But I thought like, oh, look, this is our moment. And to me, it's our moment because I find the photograph kind of beautiful, that purple, uh-huh. that green, the blue of the
yeah.
coffin.
Uh-huh.
I even find, you know, part of what actually started on me this on the story is and your listeners are going to kill me, but I'm fascinated by the folk art, the just folk art explosion of the right. And the reality is we got to up our political art game because, you know, I can walk all over in Wisconsin. There are as many great progressive flags as there are fascist flags. They tend to be concentrated in Milwaukee and Madison. And I can walk around and I can see trans pride flags and Black Lives Matter signs and so on. And it'll be the same one over and over and over and over and over. Now I just drive across Wisconsin and, you know, fascists are, some of them are flying the same flags, but they've got so many flags. I show just 9 in this story.
Right.
But I've got a collection that I've been collecting. I've got about 100. And then there's all the people who paint their own signs. I mean, it's horrible, but it is almost a kind of a folk art. I have a friend who's a Smithsonian curator of American religious history. And I said, you've got to start collecting this stuff. It's not pretty. It's ugly.
Right.
But, There it is. And it shows us something about the fascist energy, right? Like if someone's going out and like thinking about how to decorate their house and not with stuff that they ordered from Amazon, but stuff they're making.
Right.
That shows some political energy. So, you know,
yeah,
and, all and is you, not lost, but the fight is there.
Your photography is featured prominently in this, and that's a fairly recent thing for you, right? I know one of your books was Sweet Darkness, I think.
This Brilliant Darkness, was my turn to a photo, and then I love Vanity Fair because, you know, normally you write for glossy magazines, and the art department here is that a writer wants to take photographs. And they're just like, we will not speak to you again. But the 2 feet, yeah, now they're letting me, especially as I'm going around, because these stories, I mean, what are they going to do? Send a photographer to every tiny town I go to? But there is, I mean, I do hope people will sort of engage with the images and the story too, because it's inspired by this photo book, Wisconsin Death Trip. And I want us to sort of look at, there's a portrait that, you know, my favorite portrait in the piece is of a young fascist woman named Athena, a militia member, part of a fascist family. They're all militia.
There she is.
Yeah. And if I started to say, you know, a young fascist, that's not who you picture.
Right. No.
She's a complicated character. If she turned her shoulder and showed you, she's got a tattoo of a German flag with the Iron Cross on it, which she says, well, now that distinguishes me. That's not a swastika. It's an Iron Cross. But, you know, the last time the Iron Cross was used was
a swastika.
Yeah. She was and is a fascist, a very well-armed one. Her house was an arsenal.
This was an unusual family too. So you came upon another house and you wanted to take a picture of, was it the flag out front or what got you to get out of the car there?
This is in Marinette, Wisconsin, which is a small city up there on the Michigan border. And I'm just driving around and I see a flag, a fuck Trudeau flag, not fuck Joe Biden, fuck Trudeau. And I'm like, well, that's unusual in Wisconsin. So I stopped to take a picture and a woman comes out and says, you know, what you doing? And I'm like, I'm on her lawn taking a picture. I have no grounds here. It's not, I can't say, how dare you? I'm a journalist. No, I'm a jerk. I'm walking on her lawn taking a picture of her flag. So I go over and I explain myself. And it turns out it's a militia family. They had motion detectors. They had cameras.
So they knew the moment you were on their property.
They have, as they put it, several perimeters. They are ready for the feds to come. The patriarch of the family, Rob, who is also a leader of Wisconsin militia, which he claimed was 6,000 strong or 6,000 or 7,000 strong. I think that's an exaggeration,
mm-hmm.
But it was real. I saw the evidence. There are a lot. I mean, I saw the arsenal in this house. Well, I walk into the house and it's just ARs.
Well, you wrote about the cat was on the table and so you took a picture of the cat. Well, yep. Let me show you the picture of the cat.
The cat is named Twitch.
Here's the picture.
Show you when you see what Twitch is next.
Here's Twitch, the cat.
Yeah.
Surrounded by a whole arsenal of guns.
Wait, and hold that picture for a minute because, viewers, check out behind Twitch, you see just the corner of two flags.
Yep.
One is the yellow Gadsden flag, yep, the flag.
It. Yep.
And then transparent, you see a black flag, an all black American flag. That's the flag of no mercy, no quarter. It's an exterminationist flag. It's a flag of saying, in the coming civil war, we will take no prisoners, we will kill them all. That's where these folks think it's at. And so they're there training. You can also see there's a night scope there. They had just done a night ops training for about 100 guys. They were happy to welcome me in, even though they said, look, you might be a fed, but we don't care. Everything on the table is legal.
And that's disturbing that all that is legal. I'm seeing big magazines filled with a lot of bullets and these weapons. That's frightening. And the thing is,
let me rephrase that. What they said is, what you can see is legal. So I don't know what else, you know, what I couldn't see. That was definitely not, you know, and I asked him, for instance, he was carrying when, you know, he had a gun on his hip, and which is why I accept his invitation. You know, when an armed man says, would you like to come in? What he says. But he was very gracious. He was at January 6th, and in the corner of, in fact, on a TV in the corner of his room, he had looping video. He's a videographer of January 6th. He says, actually, I don't know why the feds haven't asked me for it. He says, I won't give it to them, but I don't know why they haven't asked me for it. And I said, were you carrying? He says, a lot of people were carrying on January 6th, as we know. And I said, were you carrying? He said, I can't answer that. He said, let's just say I didn't get mugged, which is this.
Wow.
You know, yeah. You know, you interpret as you will. So, I mean, and it's interesting to sort of realize, like, we see how extensive the January 6th prosecutions were. Doesn't reach down to this guy.
No, and he said it was a hoax, even though he was there, right? Did he say that?
He had some. Well, this guy was an onion. I mean, you know, I got a few Wisconsinites complain. They say, like, how dare you say we're all like that? And I'm like, nobody is like this family in the world. Because first of all, this guy declares himself Jewish. Well, it's complicated. He had discovered, you know, sort of 23andMe, that there's someone back there in the 19th century was Jewish, but he had been raised Lutheran, but he had decided to claim it. His daughter, most decidedly, with the Iron Cross tattoo, like, I am not Jewish. His wife was a Druid. His son had married a Lakota woman. He, in fact, had been part of the Standing Rock protest.
Yeah, that, I mean, it's just incongruous there, right?
It's not as, and I think this is sort of part of what I want the story to get us to think about, you know? I mean, these lines are not as neatly drawn as they are on Twitter, right?
Right.
And the reasons that people, you know, I'm thinking of a piece I'm working about in Milwaukee now, where I was talking to, you know, very staunch Democratic voter, a security guard, a black guy in a black neighborhood, couldn't stand, you know, the Republicans. And, but he definitely believed in the crime. In fact, he was a security guard and there'd just been a shootout. So he believed in crime. Crime was a problem. And I said, what do you think should be done? He says, we've got to have the military invade Milwaukee.
Oh my God.
So, I mean, so he and this guy, this militia leader, they're on the same page. And it's complicated like that. And that chaos, though, is the real danger, actually. I mean, and there's no way around it. It's we're in an explosive situation where the lines aren't neatly drawn, where mistakes can happen, where, you know, I mean, as he said, like he said, if the feds ask me to turn myself in, I will. So they come and get me. They're not getting through my perimeters, right? What if he had decided I was a Fed?
Yeah.
And they described that. They said, we have a protocol for when someone approaches our house. And, you know, what if I had gone the wrong way on that protocol? Shots fired, you know?
Yeah.
Which is the first, you know, what is going to be the first shot of this
Civil War?
A lot of fascists said it was the bullet that killed Ashley Babbitt, who's the other big subject of my book. So, I mean, we have so many people with so many sort of crisscrossed ideologies. This is not the gray and the blue. God forgive me. This is a very dark kind of rainbow of many, many hues and strange shifting alliances.
Without a doubt. Now, you know, this is based in Wisconsin, this book, but you know, I'm sitting down here.
The book is a whole country. This article,
the Vanity Fair article. And you know, but I'm sitting down here in Florida. Now, I grew up in Florida. My family moved here from New York in 1971. I went to college in Tampa and then I left. I went to New York for 5 years. I went out to LA for 15. Then I went to Taos for a minute. I went to Boston and then came back here. And I've been back here for 20 some odd years now. And I've seen this place go from a reliable blue state to insanity central right now. This is MAGA country.
The same arc as Wisconsin. In fact, I tell you, you know, listeners, crowdsource me. What I want to do, and I've got to find a magazine that'll let me do it, because I keep seeing all these profiles of Ron DeSantis. Ugh. reporters, right? I don't want to read a profile of Ron DeSantis. I understand what he is. He is not. I actually will read about Trump. Trump is a complicated figure. Ron DeSantis is not. I know what he is. He's not interesting. The profiles aren't interesting. If I want to understand the growth of that power, I think what we need is the kind of reporting where we go out and we wander Florida. And Floridians, you can be doing this.
I'm leaving. I'm getting out of here. We're moving to Arizona. No, I know Arizona's got its share of crazy too, but at least they went blue. I know. I'm going from the cliche from
the Arizona's. I really do think Arizona's more dangerous than Florida.
Do you? Wow. Okay.
Florida is, you know, Florida is not a tinderbox, right? It's red.
It is red. Florida is red now.
Arizona is, you know,
is on fire.
A lot of people with guns and
I know,
and a lot of different sides. And I want to say, like, people read this story and they encounter these militias, right? In Wisconsin or maybe in Arizona or in Florida. And I want to say this story is about Wisconsin because I was in Wisconsin. You could really write it about anywhere in the country almost. But people sort of go through this sort of thinking, well, on the one hand, these militias are really scary. On the other hand, these militias got another thing coming if they think they're going to take on the military, right?
Yeah.
They don't. They don't think they're going to take on the military. They're not fools. Rob Brum was 82nd Airborne. He knows what the military is. They understand that a civil war comes very much Crispus Attucks-like, a little conflagration, right? And it's when the seams rip in the military that breaks apart. And that's possible. I've reported on the military. I've reported on divisions in the military recently. I think we talked about it. We had in the Washington Post, a group of three senior retired generals saying the real risk here is a split in the military.
Oh, yeah.
A base in Florida trying to figure out, wait a minute, the commander doesn't think Biden's a real president. Should I obey DeSantis or Biden? And I think that's the real risk. And that's what I sort of want people to read this story and not despair.
Right. Have faith in the look. I've been saying this for the longest time as I bemoaned the graying of the leadership and the Democratic Party. Enough already. Turn it over to the kids. This is their future. And when you hear them, look, they're the ones who saved us in this election. The reason that there was not a red wave is because young people showed up this time. The same kind of people you met in Wisconsin. I have every confidence in them. We need to give it to them and let them take over.
Oh, I disagree.
Really? Okay.
Yeah. Nobody's off the hook.
No, that's true.
This is the popular front, you know? This is.
Oh, I'm not saying we give up. They just need to lead because it's their future more than ours, I think.
But I think part of our problem, I mean, now we're getting into political stuff, but I would say, like, when I look at this group of young folks in Black River Falls, all of them very earnest kids, all of them, you know, several of them raised with guns, and they're like, oh, yeah, I'm ready for the Civil War, right? Yeah. But they were the most wholesome kids you can imagine. At the same time, what I was impressed by was they had this sort of very fluid, within their group, there was no boss. They weren't interested in finding that, you know? They weren't interested in building celebrity out of their group. I'll probably piss some people off too, but, you know, what model did not work for us? I hate to say it, but the Beto O'Rourke model didn't work for us. And in Georgia, the Stacey Abrams. There's a lot of things going on there.
That's true.
And this is not necessarily to fault Stacey Abrams. I will fault that in Madison, in Milwaukee, I'd go into a little hipster lefty shop. And do I find anything about local Wisconsin politics? No, I find Stacey Abrams stickers, Stacey Abrams earrings, Stacey Abrams. That's not Stacey Abrams' fault.
No.
Wisconsin.
Yep.
Build your own. You got Mandela Barnes. You didn't show up for him. You're so busy donating to Stacey Abrams. You didn't show up for Mandela Barnes.
And they, you know, we can go back a few years. They elected Ron Johnson over Russ Feingold, who was probably one of the better members of the Senate we've ever had. So,
but no, and Ron Johnson's not good.
No,
at his job.
He's not. That's what, you know, I don't. I mean,
that's an important thing that I think also people need to start like digging into. Like, let's figure out which one of these right wingers and which one of these fascists, because some of them are good at their job, mm-hmm. right? Some of them do constituent service. And you got to pay attention to that, right? Because otherwise, we're like, I can't believe that jerk. Well, maybe that jerk really has put together, if they're smart, you know, Ted Kennedy for years and years and years got lots of conservative Bostonians, conservative white Bostonians to vote for him because he was good at constituent service. Sure. They didn't want the most liberal guy in the Senate.
But they wanted someone who'd take care of them.
Yeah. And it's right. Bernie Sanders in Vermont, too. I mean, you know, I know a lot. Look, the Sanders Trump voters in Vermont are a real thing.
Wow.
They do exist. And it's because they think Bernie does a great job. Which he does.
He does.
You're a Vermonter, as I am. He represents you well. And I'm not talking about the politics I support. He also just helps us run our state.
Yes, know? I know. And look, I think what it could have, should have. I go there too often and I need to stop. But Bernie is still doing the work. He's fighting for the people, the railroad workers, and our labor president threw him under the train. You know, I don't get it.
Yeah. I mean, it's sort of like solidarity forever, except during the holiday shopping season.
Right.
You know, it's really, isn't it dismaying? I heard you talking about this and coming on, because I get it, right? I'm as frightened of the impact of that strike as anybody, but my fears don't trump your rights.
Right.
I can't make you work. You're not a slave, right? If they want to go on strike,
They go on strike. Yeah. And who is Congress to say, no, you have to take the deal that we negotiated? Well, no, 4 of the 12 unions said, no, we need paid sick time, which is a reasonable demand. And for them to say, no, we're going to push it through anyway. No, that's...
Well, you go back to this Wisconsin story that I'm writing about. And I think these young kids were really good at sort of like seeing this kind of across this. And to put it again, boy, I like Mandela Barnes. So I'm not hitting, but when I was driving around Wisconsin as I'm writing this, and Ron Johnson would be airing the most racist ads possible at a ratio of, seemed like 3 or 4 to 1, a Mandela Barnes. And then Mandela Barnes would come on and says, people say, I want to do this progressive thing. No, I don't.
Oh,
no, I don't. You know, and I mean, they were making a bet about like maybe what white Wisconsin wanted to hear from a black man, but not those young voters, not those young kids. They're like, this is make or break, and they understood these issues. They didn't have to be educated in labor history to say, mm-hmm. hey, if you're sick, you got to take the day off. You know, it's a little bit. So the story is called The Great Acceleration. The Vanity Fair story. I'm plugging the book, which is in my new book, The Undertow, Scenes from the
Out
Slow
in
Civil
March.
War.
Yes.
Pre-order now. It helps get the book out there. But are you familiar with this term, accelerationism?
Explain. I think I get what it is, but tell
us. The right has embraced it. So Boogaloo Boys, okay. Proud Boys, Oath Keepers, Grapers, and so on. They love this idea of accelerationism. The idea is to provoke chaos, to bring it on, wow. right? To bring on the war. And in the story, I go to Waukesha, and I'm probably, I always mispronounce it.
No, that's
suburb.
Right. Waukesha.
Yeah, Waukesha, of Milwaukee. And I was, you know, that's where that horrible Christmas massacre was.
Yeah.
It's where some people know the Slender Man statues were, you know, I mean, it's a sort of not very nice suburb, but there's this, just like Wisconsin death trip in the 1890s, there's just dark stuff there. Like there is everywhere. Right. And the right is taking advantage of that. And it's taking advantage of this idea of accelerationism. Let's speed it up. Let's blow it up. They have another term, schizo wave, which is grotesque. That's romanticization of mental illness.
Wow.
It's insult. to yes. people who actually suffer.
Yeah.
And what I want us to encounter in this story, and I think it's very, very right there with like what Bernie is doing, what AOC is doing, is like, keep up. We don't want to accelerate. That's not us. We're not trying to hurtle off the cliff, but we need to keep up. We can't just be, they're racing off doing the most extreme things. And we're saying, no, could we ask for some sick days? Oh, don't go too fast
right,
now.
Right.
You know,
right.
We got to keep up.
Wow.
So the great acceleration, we need it too, unfortunately.
Yeah. Wow. We are facing, you know, people like breathed a sigh of relief over the election. I think it just bought us a little more time. If we don't our shit together, they're not easing up on that side, and you cover it beautifully. Knowing what's out there, it's frightening. One last thing that stayed with me, the picture of the cat, Twitch, with all the guns. They said their daughter was holding one, shooting one from the time she was 2.
Yeah, Athena, that woman we saw in the pink, she said she was the most extreme young woman in her early 20s, the most fascistic. And according to her father, he said, you know, he sort of believed that in his militia, this is, he had some statistics, you know, really, in soldiers, no, only about a 12 out of 100, he claimed, are actually sort of effective fighters, and only 2 are effective killers.
And she's 1.
I don't know how we knew that. And, you know, he had running around the house. There was a little 4-year-old boy, his younger son, who had already been training with ARs.
Oh,
and he said, you know, he can't hoist it. So he lies prone and fires. He says, it's really cute. And he says, and I give him a toy AR and we practice going around the house, clearing the rooms. And he runs around. He's the cutest little kid, long golden locks, yelling, clear, clear, clear.
Oh, my God.
I mean, they're preparing.
They
I don't want to prepare the same way. I can't stand it. And it's the last thing, because some leftists are like, oh, maybe we should get guns too. Forget it. You can't catch up. There's 400 million guns in civilian hands in America. They're mostly over there. We prepare not by going toe-to-toe with guns. Nobody wins that fight. We prepare. We prepare with getting sick days for our fellow
yes.
workers. We prepare by making a democratic culture that is more appealing than running around the house with a gun.
I'll quote Bruce Springsteen. We take care of our own.
Yes, yes. Nice and quick.
And we can leave it there. We could keep going forever, but we're already in overtime. Jeff Charlotte, thank you so much. I can't wait for the book, The Undertow, coming in March.
Undertow.
But you can order it now.
He's in the war. Yeah, yeah.
But for now, go to Vanity Fair. And by the way, as I told them at the beginning, I noticed when I went to log on to read it, and it said you have 2 free articles left. But it's Cyber Week, and they have a special now where a year subscription is usually $30. It's now $8, and they give you a tote bag. And you get access to the online and the print, so I subscribed. So
I'm gonna plug Vanity Fair, actually.
It's a great magazine.
Might not think it, but I've seen this in my career where the left, it's not just me writing there. They've got Jessamyn Ward writing over there. They've got a whole, and they're letting us do stuff that, I mean, I couldn't do this story in any other magazine right now.
I couldn't
do it in any. And so, I mean, Vanity Fair, you will also learn about high fashion and royals.
And see ads for things that never in your wildest dreams could you afford, nor would you pay that kind of money for a dress, a watch, a pair of shoes, a hat, a scarf.
No, but they glitter. And in between, there's just, they really
great
are.
Stuff.
Vanity Fair is stepping up to the moment. They are saying, this is a moment. We got to fight.
I agree. Well, that's why I was a subscriber before, and then I let it go, and now it was an offer I couldn't turn down, and you get Jeff Charlotte, too. Jeff, thank you again, and happy holidays, and I'll talk to you when the book comes out.
Sounds good. Take care.
Thank you so much. Bye-bye. Jeff Charlotte, again, you should be read his books, but this article is written so beautifully. Look, he's a professor at Dartmouth. He teaches this kind of writing, and he is just, he's the best at it. There's really, I don't think anybody who is at his level writing this kind of narrative today. And you get a taste of it from this, the Vanity Fair piece. I'll link to it from the blog. But if you just go to vanityfair.com, it's right up there at the top. But again, for $8 for a year, you get access to the online and you get the print magazine and you get a tote bag. I get nothing from it. Just letting you know, I saw the deal today. It's like, shit, I'll do that. $8? Got it. Okay. With that, we're done. Tomorrow's Thursday. Howie Klein will be here. Boy, do we have a lot to talk to Howie about, including the interview on Monday with Simon Rosenberg. Yeah, we've got a lot to talk about. And then Friday, in case you missed the beginning, Friday I've got a very special show planned for you. It's an interview I taped last Friday with a legendary record producer named Bob Ezrin. You can look up Bob Ezrin and you'll go, oh my God, he did that and he did that and he did that and he did that. We spent an hour together and it flew by, maybe more for me because it was bringing up old memories. But I think you'll really enjoy it. And he tells a great story about producing Pink Floyd's The Wall and the song Comfortably Numb. So good. And another great story about Peter Gabriel and the song Salisbury Hill, which I believe was his first solo single, and how it almost didn't make the album. So we have that to look forward to. And then, of course, another weekend. All right. Thanks again, everybody. I'll see you tomorrow. And I will leave you, as usual, with the news. Thank you for listening. Mwah. Bye.
It's time for Nicole Sandler's What's News from NicoleSandler.com and the Progressive Voices Network.
The Senate on Tuesday passed the Respect for Marriage Act, officially repealing the 1996 Defense of Marriage Act and codifying federal recognition of states' same-sex and interracial marriages. 12 Republicans joined every Senate Democrat in the 61-36 vote. The final bill included a bipartisan religious liberty amendment guaranteeing that nonprofit religious groups would not have to provide services or facilities for weddings they object to, and an amendment clarifying that the federal government would not have to recognize polygamous marriages. The House must now vote on the revised legislation before sending it to the president, who says he will sign it. The law also would not force states to issue same-sex marriage licenses, but would require them to recognize marriages performed where it is legal. By the way, the 12 Republican yes votes came from Collins, Portman, Tillis, Burr, Romney, Murkowski, Blunt, Capito, Loomis, Sullivan, Young, and Ernst. Now on to the looming rail strike. After four of the 12 unions negotiating for 115,000 rail workers did not ratify the deal made a couple of months ago with Labor Secretary Marty Walsh, President Biden called for Congress to step in with a legislative fix to avert what he said would be a devastating blow to the supply chain and the economy. Speaker Nancy Pelosi and Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer vowed to act quickly after meeting with the White House and Republican leaders. Pelosi saying, quote, "I don't like going against the ability of unions to strike, but we must avoid a strike." Huh? Well, union officials said that forcing contracts without paid sick leave goes against workers' interests. Senator Bernie Sanders and a group of House progressives called for votes to add a paid sick leave provision. And late Tuesday, Pelosi announced that the House would hold two votes. The first would impose the contract without the sick leave. Then they'd hold a separate vote to add 7 days of paid sick leave to the agreement. On the Senate side, Bernie Sanders is picking up support from unexpected places. Senator Josh Hawley said he would probably vote to add paid sick leave. Ted Cruz called the rail workers' request for paid sick leave reasonable. And Marco Rubio said he would not vote to impose a contract that is opposed by rail workers. So despite some tentative Republican support, this paid sick leave amendment still faces an uphill battle in the Senate, where it will likely require 60 votes to pass. Stay tuned. See, that's a heavy lift, but just one element in what looks to be a jam-packed, month-long lame duck session. The top priority is avoiding a government shutdown. So there's a few ways they can do this. Pass a long-term spending deal by December 16th. If they can't get it done by then, they could pass another short-term continuing resolution to fund the government through December 23rd, giving them an extra week to make a deal. Or they could extend it through January when the new Republican-led Congress takes over. Yeah. Or they could pass a longer-term continuing resolution to fund the government through September of 2023. So there's that. But that's not all. Congress will also decide whether to pass the Electoral Count Reform Act, add additional funding for COVID and Ukraine, and the all-important, usually unanimously bipartisan, National Defense Authorization Act, which funds the Pentagon. Good luck to us all. Well, verdicts were announced Tuesday in the trial of five Oath Keepers members for their participation in the January 6th Capitol uprising. Two of the five defendants, Oath Keepers founder Stuart Rhodes and a Florida lieutenant, Kelly Meigs, were both convicted on charges of seditious conspiracy, the most serious charge imposed on any of the Capitol insurrectionists so far, a charge that carries a potential 20-year maximum prison sentence. All five of the defendants were also convicted on counts of obstructing an official proceeding, a charge that also carries that same 20-year maximum prison term. Now, while we're on the subject of our justice system, over 60 progressive groups, including Planned Parenthood and Demand Justice, called on the Senate Judiciary Committee to investigate ethics lapses at the Supreme Court. This came after allegations that Justice Samuel Alito leaked the outcome of a 2014 decision to members of a conservative Christian group that had been waging a pressure campaign targeting the court's conservatives. That, in addition to new questions about the more recent leak of the decision that ultimately overturned Roe v. Wade. This is also a good time to mention that seven Democratic senators urgently appealed to President Biden to grant clemency to Leonard Peltier. He's the ailing 78-year-old Native American rights activist who the U.S. government put in prison 46 years ago after a trial riddled with misconduct and racism. Peltier is considered by many America's longest-serving political prisoner. By the way, the seven senators stepping up are Brian Schatz, Elizabeth Warren, Bernie Sanders, Tina Smith, Patrick Leahy, Ed Markey, and Mazie Hirono. Things continue going downhill at Twitter. They've now stopped enforcing a policy aimed at curbing the spread of COVID misinformation. Seriously, another move to loosen moderation guidelines on the site. As of September, Twitter had suspended more than 11,200 accounts for spreading COVID misinformation. But in the first 2 weeks after Elon Musk's takeover, the 25 biggest accounts spreading health misinformation had an estimated 57% increase in likes and retweets from the previous 2 weeks. Just inconceivable. And finally, the U.S. men's soccer team beat Iran 1-0 on Tuesday to advance to the round of 16 in the FIFA World Cup in Qatar. After tying Wales and England, the U.S. had to win to avoid being eliminated, and that they did. The U.S. moves on to play Group A winner Netherlands in the knockout round on Saturday, whatever that means. I got the news. And that's just a bit of what's news. For now, I'm Nicole Sandler. If you appreciate these reports and the Nicole Sandler Show, I hope you'll consider making a contribution. My work is 100% listener supported, and I can't do it without your help. Find out more at NicoleSandler.com, and please click on that donate button.